All right. United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit is now open and in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. Good morning, everyone. We're hearing arguments on re-arguments of two cases this morning. The first, docket 2009-1263, Micron Technology against Rambus. Mr. Phillips.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. The last time I was in this courtroom arguing this case, our focus was primarily on the date when the duty to preserve documents should arise, and for good reason. I recognize that that is the more significant case for the bar, but it seemed to me that it might be more appropriate in this instance to focus, at least in the first go-round or in the first push, on the question of bad faith, because it strikes me that the clearest error by the district judge and the one that most easily requires that the judgment below be reversed is her analysis with respect to the bad faith element of this case. And in that regard, it's worth quoting the district court's opinion here, because this is at page 32, which is 39 of the joint appendix. And this is the sum and substance of everything she says with respect to bad faith. Therefore, a duty to preserve potentially relevant evidence arose in December 1998, an issue I'll get back to. And any documents purged from that time forward are deemed to have been intentionally destroyed, i.e., destroyed in bad faith. I submit to you that the problem with that analysis is that it says that if you have, in fact, breached the duty to preserve documents, you have ipso facto engaged in bad faith, and that, in fact, before you can impose termination ending sanctions, that is the death penalty for litigation, that you must find more than simply that there's been a violation of the duty to preserve documents.
Well, she found that there was more than simply non-preservation, that there was almost an aggressiveness to the purging. There were shredding parties and it was more than just not preserving.
Well,
and she translated that into bad faith. Why was that wrong?
Well, I think you still have to take her at her word in terms of her explanation for how she made the determination of bad faith. And again, the first shredding party, however you want to evaluate that, of course, that clearly took place in September of 1998, which is well before December 1998. So whether that was done as a party or with whatever, it is very difficult. I don't think there's any way you can make a finding that it was done in bad faith when there is no duty at all to preserve those particular documents. So you have to look at what happens in December 1998 that would give rise to some kind of an argument of bad faith. And bad faith, according to the Third Circuit, requires that there be clear indication of a desire to interfere with the truth-finding or the truth-seeking function. And there is no evidence in this case, first of all, that shows any kind of intent like that. And second, clearly, Judge Robinson made no effort to make findings that would reflect that. And given the importance, Judge Lowry, of document retention policies in general, it is extremely critical. And it's even more critical given the uncertainty of when the duty to preserve documents arises generally. But it is particularly important that this court enforce rigorously an independent requirement that bad faith has to be shown. And frankly, if you look at the spoliation cases, they're not like this. They're not pre-litigation. They're not based on broad-based document preservation policies that are content neutral and have been found to be content neutral. They are specific instances of individual litigants seeking to destroy particularized information that is relevant and everyone perceives it to be relevant to the proper disposition of the case.
Do you think that...
But what we end up in a situation where the Board of Directors in March of 1998 is presented with a plan and a provision for the litigation and also for the licensing process. And the Board of Directors looks at it and approves it and it proceeds from that point forward. Could it be said that at that particular point in time that the preservation requirement took place? When you begin the process of establishing a structure for litigation as well as licensing, knowing very well that some people will take a license, others might not, is it that when the duty is imposed to protect the documents,
I would, first of all, Judge Garris, you'd have to be arguing that that's when the duty arises as a matter of law, because that is not the date that Judge Robinson adopted. That's clearly not the date Judge White adopted. It wasn't even the date.
I understand that, but the record reflects that there were provisions at that particular point in time which were made to the Board of Directors.
Right.
And at that point, is that when the duty arises?
Well, I don't think so, in part because if you, I just want to correct one slight misstatement. It was the strategy was to be sure presented to the Board of Directors. There is nothing in the minutes that reflects that the Board of Directors actually approved the strategy. And if you fast forward into 1999, into the summer and the fall of 1999, and when they're creating the third quarter analysis there, they keep talking about the need to go to the Board of Directors to present the strategy and to get the approval of the Board of Directors on the strategy of both licensing and litigation. So I think, Judge Garza, I don't want to war with your hypothetical, but I don't think that hypothetical doesn't reflect the facts of this particular case. All we have here is some effort to devise a broad-based strategy that's undertaken in the context of talking to litigation counsel, who tells them two things. One, there are a variety of ways to go at the licensing and litigation process, and two, as a startup company that's been in operation for more than a decade, you ought to have some kind of a document retention policy, because all businesses have them, and the problems that arise if you don't have one will be quite significant. And did not say at that point, Judge Garza, and now is the time when you should be sure to put a litigation hold on any documents that might have anything to do with patents. And to put it into context, just to kind of show you the difficulty of picking that date as the date when litigation becomes what I would say should be at least more probable, is the fact that none of the patents on which this litigation is based had even issued. Certainly hadn't issued in March of 98, hadn't issued in December of 98, didn't issue until the summer of 99, the first one issued. So it seems to me it would be a pretty remarkable notion for this court to say, post hoc, we're going to look back at what happened and what the sequence of events is and conclude on that basis that as a matter of law, anytime you devise a strategy for going forward to protect some patent rights that may or may not exist in a market where you have no incentive to create enemies, because all of the people you would be forced to both try to get a license from and sue are the people you're dependent upon to manufacture the products to be sold that will make you your profit, and all of the other conditions that Judge White articulated as contingencies that made, even in his mind, the summer of 99, which is well more, that's 14 months later than the date you articulate, Judge Garza, so it seems to me that's wrong. And it's important in that respect to recognize that with respect to Judge Robinson's analysis in this case, even in picking the December 1998 date, it seems to me she's clearly wrong, in part because I think she sets the bar way too low, even though she makes reference to reasonable foreseeability, which I think is the sort of catchphrase that everybody uses. She twice refers to potential claims as the definition of what is enough to say, okay, at this stage now you can begin to focus. It seems to me potential claims is way too far down, and that the much more reasonable approach is either Judge White's reasonable probability or the ABA standard of probability. And I submit to you there is no way that Judge Robinson could have gotten it right to pick December 1998, because the only thing that happened between the first date when the entire analysis sort of began and December 1998 is the nuclear winter memorandum. And the nuclear winter memorandum specifically talks in terms of very unlikely scenario, purely hypothetical, hopefully never, I mean, that's an analysis that does not get, I don't even think that gets you to potential claims, candidly, other than in the vaguest sense, especially since, again, you don't actually have patents at that point in time. But it certainly doesn't get you to the next.
Well, they certainly had patent applications, and they expected them to issue. I mean, the fact that they hadn't issued yet is hardly dispositive.
I'm not saying it's dispositive, Judge Lurie. I think what you have to do is analyze it the same way Judge White did, because I think he got it 100% right, which is look at all of the various contingencies that are out there and put yourself in the position of a litigant and at what, or a potential litigant, and at what stage does everything coalesce in a way that justifies taking action. And in that regard, it's important to recognize it's not like Rambis ignored all duties with respect to the preservation of documents. In late 1999, it in fact implemented a hold on those documents. And it seems to me it would be incumbent on the other side to justify why somebody operating in what appears to be good faith to preserve documents at the point in time when that individual or that company decides litigation is now more probable than not, why you would move that date back. And recognizing the risks of doing that are creating a trap for the unwary. And that risk becomes particularly, I think, unacceptable if you allow the analysis of bad faith that Judge Robinson employed in this case, where you say you breach the duty that's created post hoc, and that's sufficient to justify a finding of bad faith.
To go back to the bad faith point that you began with, assuming that we get to that question, the question of bad faith / sanctions, do you think the right approach is to send it back to Judge Robinson for her to articulate specific reasons for any conclusion that she might reach and consider the lesser sanctions as well?
Well, I mean, she clearly should have done both of those things. I think on this particular record, actually, the court could in fact conclude that there is no reasonable basis for a finding of bad faith, depending, obviously, I mean, in some ways it depends
without,
on when do you
without
when
the assistance
arise.
Of Judge Robinson's having analyzed the facts are, I mean,
but I don't think it's an accident.
Would prefer that.
I would prefer that. But Judge Robinson, I don't think it's an accident that Judge Robinson's analysis can be, the substance of it can be quoted in a single sentence. I think in order, this is just not a case in which there is any bad faith. And this is a remarkable case. Remember, the attorney-client privilege gets breached. All of the documents in the world are out there. Every third party's documents are out there. And what doesn't exist in this record? What can't you pull out of the Micron brief in this case is any kind of evidence that anybody is specifically saying, let's get rid of certain documents in order to ensure that the truth-seeking function of the district court or any other court going forward will be severely impaired. There's nothing in the record on that. All we have, so I don't think it's an accident that Judge Robinson leaps to the conclusion that you can infer bad faith simply from the breach of the duty in the first instance, because that's ultimately the only basis on which you could make a finding of bad faith. That said, Judge Bryson, obviously the court could take the shorter path and say you're going to have to make more specific findings. I would hope if the court did that, it would be very clear and what has to be demonstrated in order to show genuine bad faith, and that the requirement would be a rigorous one in much the same way, to my mind, intent is. In the inequitable conduct context, it's not enough to find simply that there's been failure to disclose material, prior art, or whatever the standard is, but you have to show specific intent to actually impair the ability in that context of the PTO to make its decision, and in this context of a district court or some finder of fact in order to make the ultimate determination of whether or not there's been any violation. But it seems to me, as I said before, the easy way for the court to analyze this case is to say, one, the district court's clearly wrong as a matter of law and bad faith, and that ultimately the record won't support it. The broader question then is, what do you do? The broader question for the bar, candidly, is, okay, at what point do you create post hoc a duty to preserve documents? And again, here, I would say that Judge Robinson clearly erred. There's no way you can justify the December 98 date. You could probably make a better argument, Judge Garza, for earlier, but the truth is everybody has rejected that, and those are all trial lawyer, trial judges focused on the very specifics of the case and concluded that that's simply not a sufficient basis. And they're clearly right in that regard. And so it seemed to me pretty remarkable for this court to say, as a matter of law, we're going to impose a duty post hoc under those circumstances.
Hypothetically, though, if you take a look at the record, there was a clear intent to establish a program of both litigation and licensing going hand in hand, pushing one product over the other so that the product would not be switched. And if you switched to the other product, litigation would arise. With that particular policy and that particular strategy, does it make sense for a corporation to say we're not required to keep all of our documents once we establish that policy, because we know we're going in litigation with some people, so we need to have those. We can't have a burn party or a tear party or otherwise. At that particular point in time, if you're destroying evidence, whether it's civil, criminal, or otherwise, there's a duty upon a corporation and its lawyers to maintain some aspect of preservation of the documents.
Judge Garza, I think the way you articulate that runs awfully hard into the Supreme Court's decision in Arthur Anderson, which, you know, is a situation where a company knows not only the possibility of litigation, but knows candidly that the United States government, which I would think is probably the single biggest litigant out there, is coming after them and coming after them aggressively. And the Supreme Court said there is no problem, because, in large part because document retention policies are ubiquitous, and they are necessary, frankly, in the world we live in, where so much information is accumulated, for any corporation to survive. And so it seems to me that maybe before Arthur Anderson you could have made the argument you just articulated, Your Honor, but it seems to me after Arthur Anderson you have to, it requires a much more nuanced assessment of at what point does litigation become more probable than not. And that's the standard she clearly did not.
I understand apply. The Arthur Anderson situation. However, here we have a little bit different nuance to it. The policy was adopted hand in hand with the litigation policy.
I want to correct you on that, Judge Garza, because you keep saying the policy was adopted. It is true that in the mind of Karp, who's a vice president, not a lawyer, he's talking to lawyers and he is analyzing this in a kind of a joint licensing litigation strategy. But one, the board didn't approve that strategy. That there was a completely separate process by which it was approved. It seems to me that if you were sitting here with something that says we are going to litigation approved by the board in minutes at some point in time, it may well be in that context you could in fact make a finding, but I still think it would have to be a finding of fact, that it is more probable than not that there will be litigation at that stage. But that's not what the record reflects here, and two, that is clearly not the way Judge Robinson analyzed this problem. She said the question is whether or not there is a potential claim that has been identified and is known by the party. That, it seems to me, is a long way from what this court has to require if it's going to impose post hoc. That's the important part about this. We're picking a date now, decades later, and saying this is what you should have done on the basis of that, when in fact this is a company that illustrated its good faith effort to comply with its responsibilities because it in fact did adopt a hold on the documents. And again, I think it's really important in this context, there's no evidence in this record that talks about make sure you get rid of these documents in order to undermine the ability of anybody to either challenge our patents or to otherwise litigate against us. Well, that's the kind of evidence you would expect to find.
The court doesn't know whether or not those documents were in fact destroyed. Contrary to what you're saying about Judge Robinson, though, she said the CARP had articulated no later in December 1998, in the same paragraph that you were reading before, and a motive for implementation of Rambis litigation strategy. Moreover, because a document retention policy was discussed and adopted within the context of Rambis's litigation strategy, courts find that Rambis knew or should have known that a general implementation of the policy was inappropriate.
Right. Judge Garza, let's put that in
that's
mind.
In December of 1998.
December of 1998, that's exactly right. And where does that come from? That's the CARP nuclear winter memorandum, in which he describes it as very speculative, hopes it never happens, you know, unlikely in all events. So while in truth he articulates a strategy, as you would expect a lot of corporate types might, and again, remember, he's not a lawyer, and he's not acting for the board. Now, what the board did do in March of 1998, it did approve, and that's the important difference here, it did approve the document retention policy, but it did that on a separate track. It did not approve the licensing and litigation strategy, because those obviously are hugely more important and ultimately contingent on some very significant future events. Because the truth is, we had applications, but we didn't have patents at that point. We were going to have to get board approval, which is embedded in all of this. And there were a lot, you know, as Judge White said, six significant contingencies in place up until you get into the latter parts of 1999. That's on that basis alone, this court should reject what Judge Robinson did under these circumstances.
Mr. Phillips, assuming that we find that Judge Robinson was correct in finding bad faith, that doesn't really end the question, because it still leaves the question of prejudice.
Absolutely, Judge. Now,
the question I have is, whose burden is it to show prejudice? Is Micron's burden to show prejudice, or Rambus's burden to show no prejudice?
I think the Third Circuit, frankly, is a little unclear on that. I don't think the law is all that clear. The truth that Judge White analyzed it in terms of, if you in fact found that the duty existed and that it had been violated in bad faith, that might create a presumption of prejudice under these circumstances. I have a hard time accepting that presumption when bad faith is based on as little as deeming it from the breach of the duty. It seems to me, if you had a real finding of bad faith, if you had real evidence that somebody's trying to destroy specific documents, and you have evidence to that effect, it's easier for me to imagine in that circumstance the burden being mine to have to come forward and explain it. The way I read the Third Circuit cases in Schmidt, the burden is still on them to come forward with a concrete explanation of what the prejudice could be.
But of course, the spoliator, the accused spoliator, is in a far better position to determine what might be destroyed, what might have been destroyed, and what effect that might have had.
In a better position, but it seems to me it's neither an impossible burden nor necessarily even a particularly difficult burden on the other side. And if you look at most of the spoliation cases, they don't have that much difficulty demonstrating prejudice. The reason it's difficult in this context is because you're talking about a situation of an across-the-board document retention policy adopted in good faith. And when you're trying to apply the spoliation case law to that, it becomes much, much, much harder. But I think the right way to think about the prejudice problem is that they have to come up with, you know, they get third-party discovery, they take depositions. You know, is there any evidence out there that, you know, somebody got an email that we didn't disclose? And there's nothing like that. And then are there categories of information where there's just simply no documents? And if you look at pages 17 and 18 of our reply brief, we go through each of the categories that Micron identified. And there are tons of documents with respect to every single one of those. And it seems to me that if you analyze the specifics of the JEDEC and the inequitable conduct, the notion that there is a basis for a concrete showing of prejudice as to either of those is virtually zero, because 1996 is when we stopped with JEDEC. If the first shred date post is before the duty to preserve arises, then whatever JEDEC documents would have been destroyed with no problem at all. And so you then have to find what documents would have survived that date and still been destroyed in the second date. Likelihood is that there's nothing in that category. Plus you have all of the documents from CRISP that say specifically what happened and who did what to whom. And we've got lots of information that the other side had access to make its JEDEC claims.
In determining this question of who bears the burden and in determining what the standard should be to determine when the duty arises to preserve documents, we haven't really talked about that, but whether it's the standard should be reasonable foreseeability or reasonable probability or imminence or some other thing, should we be applying regional circuit law, or should this be determined as a matter of federal circuit law?
As a strictly technical legal matter, I think you're clearly applying regional circuit law, but as a practical matter, because the Third Circuit has not articulated clearly precisely what the standard is, I think what this court says in this context would be, I think you would do better to not make it your best guess as to what you think the Third Circuit would do as opposed to what you think is in fact the appropriate standard, because the truth is, whatever you say in the world is going to have an enormous impact on every business that has any intellectual property rights or any interest in having any intellectual property rights.
Well, then there is, of course, the question of uniformity in applying the question of spoliation to a patent context.
Right, and that's why I think it's terribly important that this court adopt a very clear standard, which I can only urge the court to say it's got to be more than simply the ability to identify a plausible claim. And Judge Garcia, your suggestion that you can go way back in time to that point in time, it would send shockwaves through the litigating community in a way that would be very harmful, and it is, and frankly isn't necessary. And this is not a case where you need to do that under these circumstances.
Let me return to your suggestion that specific intent to destroy evidence is necessary to establish bad faith. Suppose that the contrary to your submission in this case, that we were talking about an action that was taken 2 weeks before a suit was filed,
right,
and there was every intention to file the suit, and the corporation decided discovery is a huge pain in the neck, and who knows what may come up. We have no specific knowledge of any material out there that would be damaging. Some of it might actually be helpful to us, but we know that we don't want to go through the process, therefore destroy a huge amount of material that otherwise might be discoverable,
right,
depending on what was asked for. Does that rise to the level of an impropriety that would constitute either spoliation or bad faith destruction of evidence as you're defining those terms?
Well, I think the answer ultimately would be no, because, and at a minimum, I would say that that's not the kind of bad faith that would justify litigation terminating sanctions. It might justify something about inferences, but I don't think it would justify litigation terminating sanctions. And again, because, you know, when the duty arises and when what prejudice arises is all interconnected with the bad faith analysis, it's hard to analyze each one in isolation as you're trying to evaluate the entire case, although I recognize I've disaggregated them myself for purposes of presenting the argument.
Right.
But the reality is, I think they would still have a duty under those circumstances to probably at least articulate some concrete basis for prejudice, particularly given that there is no evidence whatsoever, which you would expect there would be, that the alleged spoliator had in mind the destruction of something that might in fact be germane to the disposition of the case. Because I do think that truth-seeking function is critical.
Setting aside the sanction, though, that would, I take it from what you were saying just a moment ago, that would constitute spoliation as the term is typically used.
I think
that would be, among other things, an ethical problem for the lawyer that suggested that course of action.
Right, and part of it would depend on whether or not somebody consulted a lawyer or didn't consult a lawyer, whether it was reasonable under the circumstances to not have asked the lawyer. I mean, I agree with you. Obviously, I don't think any lawyer in the country would suggest that 2 weeks ahead of filing a lawsuit, go ahead and enjoy a shred day. I mean, but obviously that's a set of facts that are vastly different,
right,
from here. But it still seems to me it's important, particularly anytime you're dealing with circumstances like this, and you're not talking about 2 weeks, because that one seems to be might satisfy imminent. It may be that just gets you into the imminent, and therefore, that branch of spoliation is a different analysis than the one we're talking about reasonably.
Without a specific knowledge that there was a particular piece of evidence that would be particularly damaging on a particular issue, you'd say no specific intent.
I think it's important that the court at least have either that specific evidence or broader evidence that clearly reflects that anybody viewing the circumstances would naturally conclude that there's going to be evidence that's eliminated under those circumstances. I'm not going to sit here and defend the notion of conscious blindness in terms of how to approach these kinds of issues. But again, the hypothetical you pose is so far removed, and it's so important that the bad faith analysis be a very significant component of how the court approaches this case in circumstances like this, where you're talking about a neutral, good faith policy in the first place.
Any more questions for Mr. Phillips? Any more questions? Thank you, Mr. Phillips. I will save you a better time, and Mr. Hollis, whatever time you need.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The rule that Rambis asks this court to adopt would have two significant effects. First, it would bless spoliation on such a massive scale as Judge Robinson found, so as to prejudice the very integrity of the judicial process. Those findings are entitled to substantial deference by this court. Second, the rule that Rambis asked this court to adopt, which has not been adopted by any appellate court addressing spoliation issues anywhere, would in fact, and which is in conflict with the appellate decisions on governing spoliation in every other context and all the other circuits, that rule would create a spoliator's safe haven for patent cases in which particularly patent holders who can control the timing of their litigation would be in control of whether they have a duty to maintain and preserve documents. That rule, I submit, is not a rule this court should adopt, and that rule is a rule which, if adopted by this court, would A, be in conflict with every other circuit dealing with spoliation issues.
Do I hear your argument as saying don't worry about bad faith, let's just concentrate on spoliation?
No, you don't, Your Honor. Bad faith, and I'm glad you raised the question, bad faith and prejudice, it is important to understand, are relevant only to the remedy aspect of this, not to whether spoliation occurred. Spoliation itself can just be negligent. The degree of bad faith and the degree of prejudice, those two things are considered together in deciding what remedy for spoliation is important. But let's keep that line preserved between what is spoliation, which is merely the destruction of documents or other evidence which, with the knowledge that that litigation is reasonably foreseeable. That alone is spoliation. Then when you decide bad faith and prejudice, that is the question for what remedy is appropriate for that. And I would like to address bad faith because the counsel has said a couple of times there was no evidence at all of Rambis trying to unlevel the playing field or affect litigation in any way. And that was merely one example of Rambis in their briefs and in their argument, just arguing with Judge Robinson's fact-finding. Judge Robinson found the other way. She found specifically that the instructions given to Rambis employees were destroy documents which can hurt us in litigation and keep documents which can help us in litigation. She found that over and over again. And the record supports that over and over again. So the notion that is argued that there is simply no evidence at all that this is all being done in a totally neutral way with zero intent simply is warring with Judge Robinson's fact-finding, which is entitled to deference by this court. One example of that fact-finding and one example of that evidence is Mr. Hample's testimony at JA 18593. Mr. Hample's testimony says that one of the things they were told to destroy were documents challenging the validity of the patent, or which could question the validity of the patents. And they were told also, contrary to their lawyer's advice, look for things that are helpful to keep. Judge Robinson found that as well also. So the idea that there is no evidence to support her inference of bad faith and her finding of bad faith is simply untrue.
Is there a duty to preserve a document questioning the validity of the patent if that's just an internal document? It's not a piece of evidence.
It certainly would be a piece of evidence in a litigation if an internal employee said, here's a reason why
it's
our
not
patent,
a piece of prior art.
It's not itself prior art, for sure. It could lead to the discovery of prior art or other things. There's no doubt that that is evidence of a form, and it could lead to many other things. The destruction of it certainly would be violation of a duty and certainly would be improper.
Mr. Powers, when would the duty arise at this particular point? Under the facts of the case that Judge Robinson concluded started actually in December.
She did. There are
reasonably foreseeable. Was it reasonably foreseeable at any earlier time?
In my mind, Your Honor, there are three distinct time periods that are relevant in this case. The first is March of 1998, when there was a board of directors presentation which had a specific litigation plan. Counsel for Rambis says repeatedly that the board never adopted or rejected that plan. That again is at war with Judge Robinson's fact findings. She found the opposite at pages 9 and 10 of her opinion. And there is no evidence cited by Rambis that the litigation part of that plan alone was rejected. Judge Robinson found, based on evidence, to the exact contrary. And when you have a board of directors plan that is addressing that issue, which is CEO-directed, Jeff Tate directed the preparation of that plan. They spent 2 months with litigation counsel getting it ready. That plan also identified particular targets, including Micron. That plan also specifically discussed the benefits of a fast venue, not just because of a venue because of fast resolution, but because a fast venue would benefit Rambis in the litigation because it had had the chance to prepare before filing the case. So the whole point of this plan was, let's file in a fast venue because our pre-preparation, which we will have done in advance, will benefit us then. That if, in fact, litigation is sufficiently foreseeable for a company to do things to help it in that litigation, it is certainly sufficiently foreseeable to impose on that same company, at that same time, the duty not to destroy documents that might assist its opponents. It cannot be only one way. If it's sufficiently foreseeable for them to take steps to help themselves, they cannot then burden their opponents by destroying their own documents.
But you did not conclude that March 1998 was the date that the duty arose.
You're right, Your Honor.
It was December of 1998.
More precisely, she concluded no later than December of 1998. I don't think it's accurate to suggest, as Rambis does in its brief, that she concluded it arose exactly in December of 1998 based on one document and one fact alone, i.e. the nuclear winter memo. It was the sum of all of the events up until then, which included, of course, which she described at length in her opinion, which included, of course, the March Board of Directors plan and presentation. It included specifically, and this is, I think, very important, the plan that was presented to the board and discussed with litigation counsel, that they would specifically insist in their licensing negotiations on a royalty rate which they knew would drive them to litigation, the 5% royalty rate, not just as a starting point for negotiations, but as part of a strategic business plan to try to force those companies to adopt Rambis's technology, RDRAM. She found that, the evidence specifically supports that, and at JA20498, there's meeting notes between Karp and his litigation lawyer, Cooley, which specifically say, yes, that 5% royalty rate will probably push us into litigation quickly. That's in February of 1998, February, before the board plan is presented, which has that exact 5% rate. And that's the plan and discussion where they say, we need to make ourselves battle ready. We need to gather our critical documents. We need to have our document retention policy, clean out our prosecution files, and quote, in February of 1998 in that same document, we need to litigate against someone to establish the royalty rate and have a court declare the patent valid. That was the plan presented to the board in March. They knew they couldn't get people to agree to that 5% rate, and they knew they would only be able to get that rate if a court declared it to be the right rate. And they were going to insist on that rate as part of their overall business plan in order to try to push companies away from SDRAM and DDR to embrace RDRAM, Rambis' own internal proprietary technology. That was the specific plan from the beginning. And then when you look past that, they also knew in March of 1998, this is according to Karp, found by Judge Robinson in footnote 16 of her opinion, that in March of 1998, Micron, one of the specific targets of this licensing and litigation plan, they knew Micron in particular would never settle and they'd have to litigate. They would fight for tooth and nail. So if you have a company whose business plan presented to the board in March of 1998 is, we are going to insist on an exorbitant royalty rate, which we know no one will adopt, which we know will lead to litigation, our targets will not accept it, and we're going to have to litigate to get that rate adopted, and we're not going to back off of it because it's important to our plan. How in the world can you not say that as of that point there is not a reasonable foreseeability of litigation?
Go ahead.
I wanted to add two more facts if I could, Judge Bryson, before in That's response fine. To Judge Behar's question. There's two other key facts that are just before December of 1998 that I think directly support Judge Robinson's opinion. First, in April of 1998, Jeff Tate, the CEO, goes to Intel and has a critical meeting with Intel. Intel, of course, is the company that enabled Rambis in the first place. The only reason Ramis existed was because Intel said to the DRAM industry, we might want to use their architecture, therefore we can use our DRAM. Jeff Tate goes to Intel in April of 1998, this is at JA20527, and Intel says, we may be backing off of you and competing with you. Tate comes back to Rambus and is very, very concerned about it. There's a lot of discussion within Rambus about that precise issue, and a lot of great concern about that issue, because if Intel backs off and bails out of Rambus, Rambus is dead as they know it, in terms of our DRAM. And what Tate's comment about after that Intel meeting is prescient and very telling. It's, quote, we may have to play our IP card early. Close quote. The plan for Rambus, as disclosed in the documents and found by Judge Robinson as a fact, was always to sue at some point. It was to sue at the point, as what Carr put it, in October of 98, after the point of no return, because Rambus' business plan had two paths to it. One was to try to get as many companies as they could to adopt as much as they would our DRAM, Rambus' proprietary technology. They knew it wouldn't be 100%. But they wanted, as Clark put it in his October 1998 memo at JA20595, let's continue in stealth mode on our IP side until the point of no return on our DRAM. And then we can sue. And we think that point of no return will be the first quarter of 2000. And that is exactly what happened. They sued in the first quarter of 2000. So their plan always was not whether they would sue, but when. And the plan was to sue as soon as our DRAM was past the point of no return, where people had committed investments and done other things, and then they could, quote, play the IP card. That is exactly what happened to the day. And so for a company which had a plan, executed on it to the day, to litigate to the day, for them to say back when that plan was hatched that they could not reasonably foresee litigation, I think is outrageous. I'm sorry.
Quite all right. Turning to the sanctions question,
yes,
that Mr. Phillips began with, do you believe that with specific reference to the questions of bad faith and prejudice, that either A, you need to establish prejudice, and B, if so, that you need a presumption of prejudice in order to do so, in order to get to where you need to go, which is the sanction, the ultimate sanction dismissal?
There are multiple questions in
there. I'm sorry, I thought I would let you approach the problem however you like, but I appreciate you on those points.
Again, of course, bad faith and prejudice relate to the remedy question.
Yeah, we're talking about remedy. This is assuming that you've established spoliation and you're entitled to something. The question, and an important one, is what are you entitled to?
Understood, Your Honor, and thank you for the way you framed the question. The issue, of course, is whether she abused her discretion. That is the standard of review in this section, which is why I've been drawing the line between spoliation and remedy. And the question of prejudice falls into two parts. The first part is prejudice to the court. That is directly and clearly under the cases cognizable. And the second is prejudice to Micron. Judge Robinson expressly found that the scale, scope, and type of prejudice that was present here to the court justified the terminating sanctions. And that finding, I believe, is entitled to substantial deference, is not even close to an abuse of discretion, given the factual findings that she made. The second part of your question, Judge Robinson, relates to the prejudice, I think, to Micron. As to Micron, I think Mr. Phillips accurately set forth what the law is in the sense of, first, if there's a finding of bad faith, there is law that says that creates a presumption of prejudice. There is also Third Circuit law which says that the basis upon which a party like Micron, in the absence of a presumption, would establish prejudice is not, as Rambis originally argued, we do not have to say, here was a particular document which would have been harmful and it was our intent to destroy that in order to help us in the litigation. That is not the burden we have. Rambis originally suggested so, and they have now, as I read their brief, their reply brief at page 14, they have dropped that suggestion. So that is no longer an argument as to what the appropriate test is. The test under the Third Circuit is whether we have a plausible, concrete suggestion, that's the language of the cases, as to what the categories of documents might be. Now, when we're talking about destruction, company-wide destruction that is measured in tons, literally tons. The notion that there weren't plausible concrete suggestions of documents that were destroyed that could have been relevant is at one level an absurd question. They destroyed everything they could, and it's measured in tons. But second, you have much, much more than that in this case. What you have are the instructions to the employees about what should be destroyed. Those instructions included both categorical measures of, and also substantive types of destruction. So categorically, it was, of course, to destroy all email. Email is, of course, a very discoverable and often very influential part of evidence in a patent litigation, for obvious reasons. Patent prosecution files were destroyed. That is obviously potentially relevant to what would be happening in a patent case. But categorically, as I read from Mr. Hample's testimony and as Judge Robinson found, it was specifically instructed to the employees to destroy destroy documents and evidence which could be harmful to them and to keep documents which could be helpful to them. An example is the backup tapes. When somebody realized that there was a helpful document on the backup tapes, they went back through an elaborate process to restore that single document and to replace the date to make it proper on that single document, and then to wipe out the tens of thousands of other documents on the tapes willy-nilly. So it was not just an attempt to get rid of pizza boxes, as Rambis has suggested repeatedly. It was a specific attempt to unlevel the playing field. That was what Judge Robinson found. That finding is entitled to substantial deference. I do want to respond briefly, if I may, I don't think it's directly subsumed within your question, to the argument the counsel made about the standard Judge Robinson used in finding bad faith.
I'm interested in that too. So.
Because I don't think it does Judge Robinson justice. Counsel focuses on one sentence of her opinion and ignores the preceding 30 pages, which goes into great length to describe her factual findings about Rambis' conduct. Judge Robinson specifically said at paragraph 47, dispositive sanctions requires demonstrated bad faith, i.e. intentional destruction of evidence. And she found at paragraph 57, quote, the showing of bad faith is so clear and convincing. That is not a finding by a district judge that just says, I'm just going to assume it's bad faith. That's a finding that says, I've just gone through 30 pages describing their conduct in extreme detail and finding facts that were quite harmful to Rambis. And I'm saying that those fact findings show that as she put it, the showing of bad faith is so clear and convincing that terminating sanctions are appropriate. And I think that what Rambis's argument amounts to is a quibble with the district judge who, after that statement, didn't provide a pin site back to her preceding 30 pages of detailed factual findings. And I don't think that's a fair criticism of a district judge's fact finding, who had 30 pages of very detailed, very careful fact finding, which is entitled to substantial deference. And I also think that Rambis here, as I said earlier, conflates the questions of spoliation and remedy, which we already discussed that I don't want to go through again, unless Your Honor does. With respect to bad faith, though, there's another category of evidence that Judge Robinson relied upon, and which is in the record, which Rambis doesn't address. And that's evidence that goes directly to Rambis' state of mind at the highest levels. Beyond the instructions to unlevel the playing field that we've already discussed, beyond that, there are, from the president, the CFO, and the chief technical officer, over and over again, documents which show a state of mind that is almost laughing at the judicial system. And by that I have in mind the CFO at JA211412 saying, when he's describing his inability to find an important document about the Intel relationship, which is very important to this case, he said, quote, I followed CARP's, quote, scorched earth, close quote, theory of document retention and only have the attached left. That's indicative of a state of mind. You don't have a scorched earth document retention policy. That shows they knew it was intended to destroy relevant documents. The CEO, Mr. Tate, again, when he was asked to find a document that was relevant to this case related to Intel, he said at JA211390-40, quote, this is all I could find. Guess I'm zealous about, quote, document retention, close quote. That shows a state of mind where they're using document retention as a joke, in quotes, to refer to document destruction. But even more tellingly, Mr. Crisp, a key figure in this case, there were their chief technical people and their chief JEDEC person. When he was asking if anybody had a particular document that he was looking for, because he couldn't find it, because it had been destroyed, he said, quote, "Hopefully someone has one that hasn't fallen victim to the document retention policy," and then he puts a smiley face in his email. Those three documents are just three examples of a state of mind within Rambus where they are thumbing their nose at the judicial system using this document retention policy they think as a shield to destroy documents that they know are relevant and even hinder their own ability to find documents they wanted. And they were joking about it internally. That's the type of bad faith, that's the type of conduct which Rambus is asking this court to bless. And that is bad faith. And as I described the backup tapes issue, and I think that one other finding that Judge Robinson that I think is relevant to Your Honor's question, Judge Bryson, is that they specifically, as she pointed out in her opinion, went against the advice of their own lawyers to say in enforcing this document retention policy, look for helpful things to keep. That's what she found. And Rambus keeps arguing against those fact findings as if this court is the court of first instance, which it is not. I want to finish answering Judge Gaharza's question, though, because there's a third time period. We've discussed two, March of 98 and December of 98. And December of 98 is, of course, what Judge Robinson found. There's a third time period that's directly relevant, which is August of 1999. And so August of 1999 is relevant because that's the next shred party. So if litigation were reasonably foreseeable before August of 1999, then you would still have spoliation because you had 300 boxes destroyed then. And as of August of 1999, you had all of the facts that we've described before, plus three additional critical facts, one of which is the June 1999 CARP memo, which is JA 20970, which is specifically referring to litigation and licensing readiness. It says we have to be ready for litigation on 30 days' notice. That's not reasonably foreseeable. He's organizing as part of his to-do list for litigation readiness the 1999 shredding party in August. And he acknowledged in testimony that Judge Robinson specifically relied upon and found that at that point it was a written goal of the company. The CEO gave to him his goals and said, one of your goals is to be ready for litigation. So how in the world could the company now come to you and say litigation was not foreseeable when the CEO said to the VP of Intellectual Property, one of your jobs is to be ready for litigation in 30 days? Yet that is exactly what Mr. Tate told Mr. Karp in June of 1999. In June of 1999, Mr. Karp's IP update, which he circulated at the executive levels of the company, that's JA22125, specifically refers to starting the clock for computation of damages. This is June of 99, before the August 99 shred party. He says we need to start the clock for computation of damages by Q4 of 99 or Q1 of 2000. This is in June of 99. Choose one company to litigate with in Q1 of 2000. Exactly what they did when they sued Hitachi in January of 2000. Commence litigation in 2000. It's exactly what they did. But
let me ask you a question. Why don't you finish? You were going through a list of...
I only had one more thought, if I may, Judge Bryson. And that is the July 1999 document from litigation counsel at Fenwick, which specifically provided a timeline that analyzed every single possible venue and the local rules and everything that you would do just before filing a lawsuit, and specifically had a timeline showing the lawsuit being filed in October. This is a July 1999 document. So this third time period is relevant because easily you could affirm Judge Robinson's decision by finding that at least as of the August 1999 shred party, based on these documents and all of the others we've already discussed, that there is no plausible argument that this company wasn't clearly foreseeing litigation, and it was clearly foreseeable. Yet they went ahead and scheduled the August 1999 shred party explicitly as part of their litigation readiness plan. Judge Rice.
Suppose I have a patent portfolio and I decided that my business plan is to enforce patents, I'm going to be very aggressive about it. So I know there's going to be litigation down the line, but I don't have any specific target. I don't have any specific litigation planned. But I say to my employees, you know, among other things, emails are really mischievous. As you've established a moment ago, some emails can be very awkward to deal with. The policy henceforth is to get rid of all emails, just erase all emails upon being received and upon being sent, get them out of the system. When we sue somebody, then any email pertaining to that case must be preserved. But until then, across the board policy, no emails will be retained. Is that, do you think, permissible as a document retention policy by an aggressive company that knows it will be involved in some form of litigation but hasn't decided who to sue?
There's two questions, I think, embedded in that question, both of which I'd like to answer because I think they're important. First, this case is emphatically not about whether...
I understand. That's not this case.
Well, I actually wasn't even going to make that point. But I was going past that.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
This case is not about whether document retention policies are appropriate, permissible, or anything else. That is not the issue in this case at all.
But anything we say may have a downstream effect on what people feel they're entitled to do by way of document retention, or put another way, document destruction.
I would disagree slightly, and let me explain why, if I may. Let's assume that this document retention policy that Rambis adopted in 1998 had been adopted years before, when there wasn't even any argument of any litigation, that they had no bats, they had no nothing, they didn't know what they were going to do. They thought they were going to just be doing our DRAM, and that was the plan. The facts would be the same, because any appropriately adopted document retention policy, and the citation to Arthur Anderson is inapt for this reason as well, any appropriately adopted document retention policy has to be turned off as soon as there is a reasonably foreseeable litigation for documents that relate to that litigation. And so the issue is orthogonal to the question of whether there's a document retention policy, because with a policy or without, you have a duty to maintain documents that are relevant to a reasonably foreseeable litigation. So that's the first part, I think, that is responsive to your question. But there's a second part of your question I'd like to address as well, which is, what is enough to create that reasonable foreseeableness? Is it merely the presence of a licensing campaign by an aggressive licensor? And with those facts without more, I'd say no. That's not something that I believe, and again, this is one, you're going to have a much richer fact pattern when you actually have a case presented to you. That's not by itself something that I think the courts would say is reasonably foreseeable litigation at that point. You're merely a licensor with patents, and you are going to go after people that you think are infringing your patents and ask them to pay a license.
We talked about this a little bit last time you were here, and I'm still having a little difficulty with that. I mean, are you saying to me that if I have a patent and I've got it licensed to 10 people, and each of those 10 licenses are generating considerable revenues for my company, that if one of those licensees refuses to pay, contending that maybe the patent's invalid, you don't think it's reasonable for me to anticipate that I'm going to have to defend that patent? Because my other licenses are going to be in jeopardy.
Well, on that fact pattern, which is a slightly different one, I think, from the one that I recall you asking last time. The fact pattern I recall you asking last time is it foreseeable that somebody might stop paying? And I would have answered that question no. But on the question you're asking now, Judge Lynn, of if one of your 10 licensees stops paying, at that point is litigation with that no longer paying licensee foreseeable? I'd say probably yes.
Yeah. Let me return to the question I posed last time, because really that's what I was trying to get at. Because isn't it reasonable that in the course of events, someone may decide to attack and stop paying royalties? And the question is, shouldn't a patentee be preserving documents in anticipation of that? I mean, I think a normally prudent patentee would at least want to preserve things that would help its case.
I certainly understand that point, Judge Lynn, and I guess without any more facts at all than the ones you've given me, and obviously there would be in a real fact pattern, I would say that it's possible for someone to stop paying and therefore litigation happened. But I, at that point, without any more facts, would not personally call that reasonably foreseeable. Now, if you had discussions with them, or it was with a party that had a history of doing that, and there are parties that have a history of taking a license and then stopping payment and suing for declaration of invalidity and taking that to the Supreme Court and getting a new rule about DJ jurisdiction. There are parties that do that. And if that party happens to be one of your licensees, then maybe at that point it is reasonably foreseeable because it's part of their business model. My point is here, the facts that make it reasonably foreseeable are not the mere neutral facts of a licensor trying to license parties in an industry. It's a licensor seeking to impose an exorbitant royalty rate from which it will not back down, where that royalty rate it knows will push into litigation. It's been so advised that it knows so from its own experience. And it's doing so so as to try to punish, as Judge Robinson found, anybody else from using a technology other than RDRAM. A party with that business model and that business plan is creating its own sense of reasonable foreseeability because the natural consequences of decisions and acts that it's taking will be litigation.
Of course, the whole point of this is that even assuming that reasonable foreseeability is the test, reasonable foreseeability can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So the question I pose is what factors should the court consider in evaluating whether there is reasonable foreseeability with respect to a suit by a patentee?
Thank you for raising that question, Judge Lynn, because that is, I think, an important question. I don't think, in response to the first part of your question, there is or can be any doubt that reasonable foreseeability is the test. We all acknowledge that's the test. That is the test applied by every court deciding spoliation issues in patent context and non-patent context. And there's nothing specific about the patent law, I believe, which would justify creating a patent exception to the general spoliation standard applied by courts in all forms of litigation. And so that's the first point. The second point is that in many, many, many areas of the law, reasonable foreseeability is the test that's applied in spoliation and non-spoliation contexts. When you look at the tort contexts and securities fraud, lost profits, damages, environmental, there's many, many areas of the law where reasonable foreseeability is a test that it's applied. And I would argue that what some may see as vagueness is a benefit in its flexibility. It can handle a wide variety of factual situations, and although there's not a precise formula, of course, for reasonable foreseeability, there isn't one for obviousness or claim construction either. There are nuances to those tests which are important to handle the variety of factual contexts in which they arise. And that test of reasonable foreseeability, is applied throughout the law. But one example of an answer to your question, one tool in the toolbox of judges trying to apply reasonable foreseeability, at least in the tort context, is what are the natural consequences of the acts you've taken? That's true in tort for sure, and that standard is applied throughout. Well, if you apply that tool to this context, and you had a licensor who said, my plan is to insist on a royalty rate which I can only get adopted if a court enforces it, because nobody will agree to it, and I'm going to insist on it because I need to do so to get people to adopt our DRAM. The natural consequence of that business plan is litigation.
So just trying to understand, we need to wrap up the argument, we have another one, but just trying to understand the consequences of all this. Here we have a company, a relatively young company, doesn't have a document retention program. So it goes to litigation counsel because it's in a business that's fraught with litigation, no matter what. So litigation counsel says, well, you know, what about your document retention program? They say, we don't have one. So he says, well, you ought to. It's urgent that you have a document retention program that's standard in industries. So they do. So I think I hear you saying that advice was incorrect, should not have been followed, because the client should have thought about, we're probably going to litigate, we've been given the wrong advice, and therefore we're going to keep what they describe as piles and piles of papers because we know better,
In the abstract, Your Honor, I would not disagree with that attorney's advice. If all the facts that we had were those that you described, a young company in a generally litigious field coming to an attorney and the attorney saying, you're getting to be a mature company and therefore you should have a document retention policy because that's what, as a matter of corporate governance, companies do.
And we've got a lot of recalcitrant licensees or potential licensees, which perhaps is closer to these facts.
Depending on the level of recalcitrance, now we're going to get into the issue. But let me at least try to draw a clear distinction in response to your question. If, using whatever standard we have, there is no reasonably foreseeable litigation at that point, there is no problem in adopting the document retention policy. This case is not about the adoption of document retention policy in the abstract.
Where would one go to litigation counsel, perhaps, at that stage? Just trying to keep it within the general framework of the facts that we have here.
But you're ignoring those facts, I think, are important, and often you're right, they wouldn't have gone to litigation counsel, they would have gone to their corporate counsel, and the corporate counsel would have recommended the document retention policy. But it's not even the fact that they went to litigation counsel. It's the fact that at the time they were doing this, it was part of a litigation plan presented to the board of directors. And so the issue isn't the adoption of the document retention policy at all. The issue is if litigation was reasonably foreseeable, either with the litigation document retention plan or without a document retention plan, they are not free to destroy documents if litigation is reasonably foreseeable. And under these facts, where you have their business plan guaranteeing litigation, where they're spending months and months preparing for litigation, saying, we want to pick a fast jurisdiction because that'll benefit us because we're going to create a discovery database, we're going to pick our experts in advance, we're going to get all of our documents in order, and so then when we go through a very, very fast docket, that will be an advantage because we've done all this preparation.
So they were given the wrong advice, you're saying?
They were given the wrong advice in part because they didn't tell the lawyer who gave them the advice all the facts.
How do we know?
We know because Dan Johnson testified in the Micron case, and over again, when we presented the internal documents that I've been describing to you, over and over again, he said, I didn't know that, and I wouldn't believe it. He was surprised when we showed him, in cross-examination, the documents showing they had specific plans to litigate. And in fact, at one point, he exhibited shock. And that's Dan Johnson was the lawyer who they were saying throughout this case, at least in part, whose opinion and advice they were relying upon, and yet they kept from him material information. And in fact, there's nothing in the record that says they ever actually told him that they did implement a 5% royalty demand as a matter of board policy. They told Dan Johnson in February of 98 that that's what they were going to ask for, and he laughed, according to his testimony. Literally laughed and said, well, you're going to have a lawsuit on your hands if you do that. You don't want to be doing that. And then they did exactly that. And they didn't tell him that. They didn't tell him that they were picking specific litigation targets. They didn't tell him that Micron, they knew from their experience in the industry, that Micron specifically would fight tooth and nail. They didn't tell him that they were going to be ready for litigation on 30 days' notice, that that was a specific written goal of the company. He testified over and over again, I wasn't aware of that. So they can't shield conduct by saying they got advice from a lawyer who they kept deliberately ignorant of the key facts about which they were going to be basing their litigation plan.
Okay, thank you. Any more questions, Mr. Powers? Thank you, Mr. Powers. Mr. Phillips, we've raised a lot of new points, so take what time you need in rebuttal.
I appreciate it, Mr. Zuma. I'll try not to overindulge myself here. It's a little frustrating to analyze the case at this point because Mr. Powers throws in a lot of facts, but you know he's absolutely right. You have to evaluate each of them in the context of the specific timing. You can't just mix and match facts as they arise, throw them together. When some of them arise with respect to March 98, some of them arise with respect to October, November, December 98, and some of them arise with respect to 99, and say, well, facts from 99 get the feedback in to the circumstances in 1998. So what do we know in March of 1998?
First of all, we know that they went to outside counsel. They sought advice. They went to both corporate and litigation counsel. It was the decision of the law firm to bring a litigator along. They brought a litigator along, and he did exactly, Judge Newman, what you specifically proposed, which is he said, look, if you don't have a document retention policy, you ought to get one. And these are the rest of the plans that you ought to go through in terms of licensing and ultimately with respect to litigation. It's a lot of fuss about the 5% royalty. That was a fact that was told to Mr. Johnson at the first meeting. If he thought that the fact that you had in mind a 5% licensing royalty was going to generate immediate litigation, you would have expected him to say at that point in time. Now realize, if that's what you've got in mind, that's your strategy, pull the plug on that document retention policy. He didn't say that. Why? Because they're just talking in general about the strategy. And the truth is, there's not a shred of evidence in this record that they actually ever insisted on a 5% royalty. Let's get back to reality here. We're talking about March of 1998 for litigation that begins in 2000 and a whole string of events that take place in between that time. And a lot of those events you simply cannot put back in, particularly in this context where you're talking about a situation where the district judge herself doesn't impose a duty to retain anything based on the conduct arising in March of 1998. Even under her theory, no duty arises until December of 1998. And even though counsel says it doesn't start before then, her specific finding is that it arose in December 1998. She says at one point up to, and then in the next page, when she's dealing with the bad faith argument, she says it arose in December of 1998. She says at one point no later than, but when she's tying it to bad faith, she says that the duty arose in December of 1998. And it's important on the bad faith element, because I started there, I don't want to end there, but I do really want to focus on that. Because the fundamental issue with respect to bad faith, Mr. Powers tells you there's all of this evidence of bad faith in this particular record. The truth is, everything he comes to turns out to be in footnote 27 of Judge Robinson's opinion. And it's worth reading, because first of all, it says at the bottom of the several slides, contrary to Johnson's advice, Carp wrote, quote, look for things to keep. Now, it's interesting. Every single time Mr. Powers made reference to that language, he inserted the word helpful. But that's not the finding. That's not either the language in that document, and that is not the finding that the judge made below. It wasn't to keep helpful things. It was look for things to keep generally. That is be over-inclusive in the documents you keep.
It says help establish conception and prove Rambis had intellectual property. The word help does appear there.
Help appears with respect to her characterization at the back end, but with respect to the specific document, the document she quotes, Karp wrote, look for things to keep. And then she cites the second part. Along those same lines, Karp explained to the engineers that one category of documents they should not keep, that is, one of the things document retention policy was targeted to expunge, were documents questioning the patentability of Rambis inventions. That is the only statement in the record that even remotely suggests that there's any kind of a targeted effort here. It's tagged to a footnote that stands for the proposition Karp's slides from those presentations outline the policy, a policy that the judge clearly and correctly found was it was content neutral and an across-the-board policy and adopted at a time when there was no duty to preserve any documents. So it seems to me under those circumstances, the notion that somehow the document retention component of this is in any way done in bad faith at that stage cannot be supported. And it is not an accident, as I said to you, Judge Bryson, that she does what she does in her opinion, the sleight of hand of saying, once you have a preservation of document duty that arises and you breach that duty, then you have intentional destruction of documents, i.e. bad faith. That's her analysis of bad faith at that point in time. It has nothing to do with the 30 pages of previous findings, many of which have nothing to do with the relevant time frame for purposes of analyzing this particular issue. With respect to the board, right, I think it's important to the court recognize, because Judge Garza, you raised it a couple of times, 20511 is the joint appendix citation, the board minutes, which exist, so those board minutes were not destroyed. At this point, Joel Karp joined the meeting and updated the directors on the company's strategic